Succession, number 30494, Reel 1.
That'll restart Reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Bowness in Scotland. My father was in the Navy and my mother, my young mother, was up in Scotland at the time. And it wasn't the done thing to have a baby in a hospital in those days. The hospitals were sort of for poor people, so I think I was born in probably a room boarding house or something. And I had a Scotch nanny, and then 4 years later my sister was born. But when I was born, the only thing I can remember about the First World War was Zeppelins, because it was such a lovely name, the Zeppelins. And I can remember one terrible occasion when my little sister, who was only a few months old, disappeared. We were then living in Sheerness, and my father was serving in Plymouth, and my baby sister and the nurse had disappeared. And I had a wonderful day because one of my father's sailors took me on his shoulders all round Sheerness saying, "Have you seen a young woman pushing a pram with a baby in it?" My little sister. And I loved it, and he was kept giving me sweets and things. And then on a beach we found the pram. Thank God my little sister was screaming inside the pram, and the nurse was way out at sea. I don't know whether she was trying to commit suicide, but apparently my mother hadn't gone into her references very carefully, and she'd just come out of a mental asylum, so that was rather alarming. My father died when I was quite young as a result of war injuries he received in the First World War. And my mother was a poor widow, but she had lots and lots of admirers who were called uncles. And the uncles used to take her abroad, and they used to give us nice presents. And I remember one particular one called Uncle Peter, who took my mother on a big game hunt in India, which was very exciting for her. And eventually, my rich cousins paid for me to go to a very expensive girls' school. And because my address was Manor Cottage, some of the girls were very beastly to me and said, "Does your mother take in washing? You live in a cottage." Because they all seem to live in stately homes in Scotland. Anyway, at school, I had two ambitions. I wasn't very bright, but my two ambitions, one was to become a film star like Greta Garbo or someone. The other was to marry the Prince of Wales, who was then, I suppose, in his early 30s or something. Well, when I left school, a rich cousin presented me at court, and there was the Prince of Wales standing just behind the throne with the Duke of Kent and the Duke of Gloucester. And suddenly I realized he didn't appeal to me at all. He looked a bit boring. And I went off the Prince of Wales, which was just as well because I had fallen in love with Mrs. Simpson. Well, extraordinarily lucky. I got into RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Just before we go on to that, which school had you been?
St. James's in Worcestershire. And the Duchess of Gloucester was head girl. So, not when I was there, but in her day. So, it was a very grand school.
Had you enjoyed school?
Bits of it I enjoyed. I was very bad at arithmetic, but quite good at English. I loved the literature lessons, the Sanskrit I gave. And I wasn't much good at games, but I was very good at deportment. And I made one or two very nice friends. I quite enjoyed school. I wouldn't say I was thrilled to leave. But when I went to RADA, I'd never been in London before on my own. And it was wonderful. All young people lived in bed sitting rooms in those days. You had a bed sit. And mine was just behind Oxford Street somewhere. And my landlady, Mrs. Dearlove, used to get rather cross because I used to throw my keys out of the window so my friends could get in the front door and come up and have coffee or tea. And we used to have bottle parties in those days, which meant I didn't have to spend anything. Everyone bought a bottle of cider or something. And I was always falling in love. I had a lovely boyfriend at Cambridge who had a car called Agatha and a Morris Cowley, I remember. And it was always, we were always having punctures. Cars were pretty ropey. Anyway, because I went to so many parties, I didn't do very well at RADA. I should have done. In the class with me was an actor who became very famous, Trevor Howard. And I don't know, if I'd been more conscientious, I might have become a good actress, but I wasn't. And the only job I could get when I left RADA, rather early, was in a pantomime in Birmingham with George Formby. I've ever heard of him, who sang songs with a ukulele. And that was Dick Whittington. And I was a fairy. And I had to say, stop, wicked rat. When sunshine is about, there's only one thing you can do. Get out. And I remember that. And I had quite a dolly time in Birmingham for about 6 months and fell in love again. And then I went on tour in a play called Idiot's Delight, and Sarah Churchill, Winston's daughter, was in it, and she was just a year older than me, and we had a joint birthday party in October, I remember, and she was such a sweet girl, but she drank, which was terribly sad, because the Churchills did drink. It was really in their genes, and she died when she was quite young. Well, after Idiot's Delight, which we toured all over the place, including Dublin, it was very popular, war was declared, and I was quite relieved in a way, because I was never going to be a good actress, but it gave me an excuse for not going on trying to be an actress.
How had your mother felt about your acting?
About the acting? I think she... As long as she, my mother was hoping I'd meet a nice, rich young man, and she didn't want me to fall in love with an actor. She was horrified that I might. I had a boyfriend called Black Jack, who was actually white, but he had very dark hair, and he was always in trouble because he drank too much, and my mother thought, ugh. I think she was quite alarmed by some of my boyfriends. Anyway, where we got to, I joined the Wrens, and we had no uniform, nothing to begin with, and we had to share what were called the heads the sailors lose with them. And I remember having been brought up, although I'd been on stage, I was quite a fine young lady, going to the heads for the first time, and my horror, there was a thing written on the wall: it's no use standing on the seat. The crabs in here can jump 6 feet. And that frightened me to death. Well, my job in the Wrens was to fill in... I was a writer Wren, and I had to fill in sailors' certificates, put down their religion, whether they could swim or not, whether they were married, what diseases they'd suffered from, how old they were, just statistics. It was quite a boring job. And Portsmouth was always being bombed. I lost, when the uniforms came in, first raid, I lost all my uniform because the building I was in caught fire. And I spent a lot of the time in the shelters. We were bombed terribly badly. The barracks caught on fire. And we had a very cold winter because all the glass in the barracks was blown out. And I remember I was so cold, I used to keep my overcoat on and sit with my feet in a waste paper basket, kept them warm. And Portsmouth was okay. There were lots of... And I used to go up to London to parties, but London was always being bombed. And it was quite a sad time because I had a special boyfriend who was a submariner, and he was killed. And then someone else in the fleet, IRM, and he was killed, and... It was all very sad because I was in my 20s and very romantic. Well, then it was decided that I could be an officer, and I was sent up to London for an interview with, I think she was called Lady MacDonald, and all she wanted to know was, what did your father do? She was a terrible snob. And I said my father was in the Royal Navy, so that was a plus. And what is your sort of, tell me about your relations. So I had a duke in the distance. I pushed him in. And the next thing I knew was I went to Greenwich, the Royal Naval College, which was fabulous. There we learned to be officers and ladies, and which knife and fork to use, which one roughly knew, and that sort of thing. But it was really great fun, and I met some very nice girls who became great friends and lasted most of my life. And we had drill with us, Sergeant Major, and I was one thing I was good at, I don't know why, I was drill, and I really loved it. Then,
what was the discipline like for the?
The discipline was really rather strange. You learned how to sort of stand up at the tea party, holding a cup and saucer in your hand, and being able to introduce people. And we all smoked in those days. Everyone had a cigarette in one hand, and the discipline was mostly good manners and drill. And a few of the girls were very intelligent, and they got jobs in navigation and things. I wasn't. So I got a job as a censor officer, which was, the censor office was in High Holborn, and we censored the letters with scissors. So it meant you cut them to shreds, because most of them were written both sides of a bit of paper. And it really broke my heart sometimes. The censor was so strict, you couldn't mention the climate, the names of anyone. You couldn't mention, of course, where you were. You couldn't mention, practically the list was so long. And poor little sailors, some of them had hardly had any education. They wrote I with a little I, and the end of the letters they put S-W-A-L-K, which was sealed with a loving kiss, and you couldn't censor that. That stayed in. And then G-U-T-S, which was get up them stairs, and Holland, which was hoping our love lives and never dies, and you had to learn all those silly things. But after the censor office, I was sent to Dover, where we were, they were still shelling us. It was nearly over, the shelling, but it was quite exciting. And all the shops had gone. Dover was totally deserted, except for a tattoo shop where the sailors used to be tattooed. And then from Dover, now as an officer, I went to Liverpool, and that was being bombed, of course. And I think from Liverpool, I got a job in a little fleet. By this time, I was a fleet mail officer, which meant I saw the censored mail was sent wherever it had to go. And Shoreham by Sea, I shared a flat with another wren because there wasn't a wrennery, and we had great fun. Then I, by this time, I suppose it was 1942, and I applied to go abroad, and so next thing I knew, I had a Polish boyfriend by this time, and he saw me off at King's Cross to Greenwich. And then I've got quite a funny description of getting on board the train, because, shall I read that to you all? Oh, dear. This is all.
How did the process work for volunteering for overseas?
How did it work? Oh, I think they I think you applied, and I think then they saw that you were a healthy girl. I didn't want to send someone overseas who wasn't particularly healthy. They didn't ask about languages at all. My past record showed I'd been in a lot of, I mean, I'd been bombed and bombed and bombed in Liverpool, Portsmouth, Dover, and I suppose they thought, poor girl, she deserves to get out of the country. And also, by this time, I knew quite a lot about how the fleet mail offs worked. It was terribly secret because, of course, if the enemy knew where the mail was going, we had to sort it out. And I had a thing called a pink list, which showed you where every ship was. And that was top secret because if the navy, if the Germans had got hold of the pink list, it would have been two awful words. So there was a lot of great secrecy about it. And there was a lot of terrible times when one ship, Penelope, didn't get any mail for 6 months because she couldn't be, there was never a port where the mail could be sent. And there was a mutiny because the sailors didn't know whether they'd fathered a child or whether they were, that they knew their wives were probably being bombed and they didn't know what, you know, it must have been dreadful to get no mail. It was really dreadfully important. So Fleet Mail Office in Alexandra was a very important one because it was sort of a big depot at Ras El Tin. I'm just trying to find out where I got on board because it's really quite funny. That's all Greenwich. That's so that's off one terrible time in Portsmouth when I was bombed. The shelter I was in was actually bombed, and a very nice sailor. A kind sailor shouted, "Follow me," and I was led on the longest and most exciting obstacle race of my life. It was obvious that the blitz would continue until dawn, and my sailor presumed that the center of the city and the dockyard would be the main targets. So we aimed for his home on the outskirts. As we ran, we were often confronted by buildings blazing, great gaps in the roads, thunderous crashes, and flashes of light which lit up the whole devastating scene. Quite often, our route was blocked by fire engines and ambulances. Eventually, we reached a row of council houses with small gardens. My hero's family owned a shelter which all the neighbors seemed to be sharing. I squeezed down the steps and found myself lying across the vast stomach of a weeping woman who assured me she would die if I didn't undo her corsets. Fortunately, or we would all have suffocated, it wasn't long before dawn made it possible to leave the shelter. Squeezing down into that was terrifying. Oh, here we have getting on board this ship. That's Liverpool. Where is this? Actually, this is all quite fun to read because it's quite racy.
This is your life in Liverpool, is it?
This is, we've had, yes, Liverpool was. This is my destination. This was going to, it was supposed to be a secret, but I had to order a tropical uniform and have a great many jabs. So it was the Far East or the Near East. It didn't matter, just so wonderful to be getting out of England. Our clothes had to travel in a tin trunk, beware of ants, and we had to take bell-bottom trousers in case of shipwreck. Somehow we discovered I was going to Egypt. My poor mother was very depressed. My sister was in Scotland, and my mother wasn't as confident as I was, as I never read the papers or listened to the news. Someone could always be relied on to tell me the bad news. My last night in England, George, that's a Pole, took me to a very elegant flat in Belgravia, where some young friends of his were giving a party. My train was due to leave for Greenwich at about 8 p.m. King's Cross. King's Cross, like all stations, was only partially lit by dim blue lights, and I couldn't find the group I was meant to be travelling with. So I jumped into the nearest compartment, which was a sleeper and seemed to be empty. George, rather drunk, said he hated goodbyes, gave me a very pretty Polish cap badge embroidered in petit point, and staggered away. Almost immediately, Billy, that was my other boyfriend, appeared and gave me some golden enamel cufflinks. As soon as the train started, a very tough captain from a parachute regiment appeared in my sleeper. He had just finished an assault course, and to prove this, leapt onto the top bank and down again. What a night we'll have! He was drunk, too. Oh, my pretty wren, what a night we'll have! He produced a bottle of gin and said he couldn't wait to tuck me up. Terrified. I said I was desperate to spend a penny, which was what one said in those days, and could at the same time clean my teeth and prepare myself for the assault. I didn't find the Wren contingent, but three army nurses let me share their compartment. When we arrived at Greenock, the Wren officer in charge was a bit stuffy about my non-appearance. Hedy, she was my much younger friend, was in the party, about five officers and 15 Wren ratings. In peacetime, SS Oran was a passenger ship with an overall complement of about 2,000. But now as a troop carrier, there were 20,000 on board, soldiers bound for the Middle East. The conditions were appalling, not for us, for we had a cabin for four on B deck. We were to be the first convoy to sail direct through the Mediterranean and not go via the Cape, which would take months. Almost at once, two RAF officers got up a small concert party to entertain the soldiers. Six of us made up a chorus, wearing scarves around our hips and bosoms. I appeared in two of the sketches. In the first, I was Madame Zelma with Alphonse, my performing flea. Alphonse did all sorts of tricks, and then, Mon Dieu, where is Alphonse? Oh, he is not here, he is not there, he is not... looking at various parts of my anatomy, and then great laughter. I had to find him on whichever was the most senior officer present. Oh, you naughty Alphonse, you go to join your friends, yes? In the other old chestnut, a sailor wrecked on a desert island finds a very flirtatious native girl, flowers behind the ear, etc. And after a lot of jolly badinage, she asks him what he liked most in the world, and he says, a game of darts. Poor soldiers, they could only go on deck in short shifts, otherwise hardly had space to move, and the smell of sweat and vomit was excruciating. We had to censor their letters home, and some of them couldn't understand why, when we were fighting the bloody Huns, they weren't going to Germany. We were escorted by a cruiser, HMS Birmingham, two destroyers, and some frigates. After a few days out at sea, a Messerschmitt was spotted, and we were then dive-bombed, on with the bell-bottom trousers and our life jackets, and these we wore night and day, spending most of the time lying on our stomachs in the huge main lounge. Hedy, that's my little Irish friend, had made friends with a young Welsh lieutenant, RNVR, who was a famous rugger international. She used to wash and iron his shirts. And while we lay on the floor, he played the piano and sang for us, and we did our best to sing with him. It wasn't too bad, except for the rather alarming noise of gunfire and the urge to pee. HMS Birmingham got a direct hit in the engine room. One sailor was killed, and a future friend, Bob Penhaligon, was quite badly injured. Did we lose a frigate? I think we did. Isn't that awful, not knowing? On board was a commander, Hugh Shah, bound for Egypt as senior medical officer. He'd never been to the Middle East, but gave us a talk on hygiene, warning us not to eat any fruit, vegetables, or salads unless they were first boiled in salt and water, because the natives had rather a disgusting way of watering them. We must always wear bloomers with elastic in the legs as we could be stricken with terrible diseases from the contaminated dust. As for VD, well, he wouldn't mention it because we weren't those sort of girls. Dear old Hugh, he came from a very profitable practice in Hampstead and told us what a wrench it had been to leave his wife. But he probably enjoyed the best years of his life being a father confessor to the Wrens. We docked at Portside and thence by train to Alexandria. From the windows of the train, we could see the land being ploughed by oxen, just as in biblical days. Oh, look, there's a camel. It was so exciting. Look at those Arabs waving at us. No, don't look. Oh, how revolting. Perhaps Husha was right. And then I go on, the Wrens were quartered in Rurasafa, where, and we used to play, striptease with the convalescent, not striptease, strip poker. And the Wrens were very good at playing strip poker. All they did was wear four pairs of tights and three pairs of, so they always won. And this is just about, I did have one interesting experience while I was in, well, I had quite a lot. I had to have a small sinus operation, then I was allowed some leave, and I went up to Bramana in Beirut, and what happened there? I remember on the way, I was driven by some American naval officers, and the beautiful car broke down. And my first glance, these Americans were going to drive me to Beirut. When my first glance, the Americans were not film stars, 40-ish. Howard, a lieutenant commander, was going to Beirut as American liaison officer, and Dan, about the same age and rank, was on leave from Baghdad, a city he hated. Howard sported a black moustache, which always looks odd to the Royal Navy, as King's regulations say you must be clean-shaven or sport a full set, which was a beard and moustache. We set off early. The Plymouth was very wide, and they insisted that I sit between them. About noon, driving through the desert, the Plymouth developed engine trouble. We ate our sandwiches and consulted a map, but of course were miles from anywhere except desert. Fortunately, it was a sensible army map and pinpointed an Italian prisoner of war camp not too far away. So we bumped and jerked our way there. The camp was charming. The Italians were notorious for not trying to escape. In fact, most of them were delighted to be captured. They had managed to make neat little paths among their huts and had built a little church with a big carved cross. They had even grown flowers and, of course, vegetables. A team of eager mechanics hoisted the Plymouth above the ground and, all talking at once, set about finding the trouble. The work they were daily employed on was to make coffins for the army. It was blisteringly hot, and soon I was led away to a vast shed where hundreds of coffins were neatly stored. There was nowhere to sit, so I lay in a coffin. They brought me a glass of water and an orange, and soon a queue had formed to kiss my hand and just stare. Probably for some, it was quite a while since they'd seen a female European. I had to look at snapshots and photographs of wives, mothers, and children, and must have said, "Bella, bella, bellissimo, bella bambinos," 100 times, When they left, we all cheered. Oh, wasn't that sweet? I remember those prisoners of war all saying to me, when the war over, or when the war over, and I kept saying, oh, very soon, very soon. It was about another year or so. But poor Italians, they were so unwarlike, really. I mean, I believe they were rather horrid to some people, but on the whole, Italians don't like war. So that was quite an interesting little anecdote.